Thank you, worship team. That's really been my prayer this week, that song actually, that we would truly be a people, a church that recognizes our need for God and lives in such a way. And for this, our second last Sunday in this Psalms of Summer series, I've chosen to talk about kind of what I call the thirsting for God or the passion for God Psalms. And Psalm 27, you heard Devin's musical composition there at during the offertory. That would be one example of a passion for God psalm. And Psalm 42, I invite you to turn there. That would be another one that we will look at this morning. And great to have you here. My name is Rick, if we haven't met yet. And have enjoyed this summer going through the book of Psalms here. Now, Psalm 42, when I was reflecting on it this week and thinking about it, kind of the image I got to mind, came to my mind was that of a roller coaster. Because it seems to be this roller coaster of emotions that the psalmist goes through. So why don't we stick, oh, there's a roller coaster. Anybody recognize that one? Yeah. Yeah. Woo. Yeah. Who's been on that one of the P&E? Yeah. Okay, many of you have been on it. I gotta admit, I haven't been on it yet. Now, it looks kind of old. You know, it looks like as old as the White Rock Pier. And we know what happened to that. So, I don't know if I want to get on there. My daughter asked me to go on Labor Day weekend. It was named the top wooden roller coaster in Canada. The 12th best wooden roller coaster in the world. Which is quite a feat considering there's roller coasters on every continent except Antarctica. You know, and you can go 45 miles an hour on that thing, 2,840 feet of track there. And like I said, Psalm 42 is kind of a little bit of a roller coaster kind of a metaphor for me that you will see as we read it, kind of these mountain highs, these times of joy, and then also kind of the quick, severe turns down when there are times in life when there's depression or despair. And then, again, rising up to times of hope and peace and joy. Psalm 42, let's read it together. We've got it up on the screen here. Why don't we stick it up there? And so we'll do an alternating men and women type of reading through this psalm. So men, let's start out. As the deer pants for streams of water, why, my soul? Okay, do you sense the roller coaster of emotions there in Psalm 42? Men, the part that you were reading, kind of some of those downcast times. And then women, the parts that you were reading, some of those verses of hope that he gives us. And so Psalm 42, you see a heading there in Psalm 42? What does it say there above it? It says book 2, right? So this is the start of book 2. Kind of the Psalter is divided up into five books. The first 41 Psalms are written by David, although some of them don't have superscription on them, but we're assuming David wrote them. Then you get to Psalm 42. 42 to 72 is book 2. That's written by a whole variety of authors. I think like about 7 or 8 different authors, including this one, Psalm 42, for the director of music. It says, a maskil of the sons of Korah. So Korah, we know, was a guy who led a rebellion against Moses and Aaron. Now, he and his family were killed, but some of his sons escaped, and they went on to have families, and they went on to write some of the Psalms. And we don't know if this was a pre-exile psalm kind of written around the time of Moses, or I'm guessing more likely it was post-exile. And so it would be kind of one of the sons, great-great-grandsons, one of the descendants of Korah, would have written this psalm. So it gives you a little bit of background around the psalm. Now we see here kind of this psalm I would call like a psalm of anguish. You know, you see some of the verses that we read. My tears have been my food day and night, while people say to me all day long, where is your God? This is a guy who's not in a happy place, right? If his tears are his food, and the people oppressing him in terms of saying, hey, where is God for you in this? And then verse 10, he says something similar. My bones suffer mortal agony as my foes taunt me, saying to me all day long, where is your God? So like I said, we don't know exactly when this was written. You know, if it's kind of pre-exile, you know, around the time of Moses, we're not sure who the enemies are he's referring to there. You know, it could very be that he's going through some difficult circumstances. Maybe the enemies are in his head. You know, maybe the enemies are that voice that sometimes within us says, where's your God? Why isn't God coming through for you? You know, if it's a post-exile psalm, which I'm guessing it kind of is, because he makes reference there about going to the house of God, how I used to go to the house of God and worship. So he's probably remembering back to when they used to have temple worship and kind of reflecting back. Perhaps he's in Babylon in exile, you know, perhaps living in a refugee camp. Maybe some of his family members have been killed. Maybe the enemy there is taunting him. Where is your God? Look at you. Now you're here in Babylon. In captivity. You know, we're not sure exactly there, but he's going through this time of lamenting, this time of anguish. To loosely quote C.S. Lewis, who says, it's not easy being a believer. It's not easy being a believer because every war, every calamity, every famine, every kidnapping, every act of terrorism, all of these things, in a sense, speak against God. Does God exist? Or sometimes we feel, God, are you here for me? And there's results in this self-talk when we feel like the psalmist, that our tears are our food day and night. We feel depressed. We feel in anguish. We wonder, God, I used to experience you. I used to feel close to you, but I don't now. And sometimes for some of us, yeah, we may believe God exists, but does he care about us? What about when we don't see him work in our lives? In 2007, there was a young man, Matthew Murray, who went onto a YWAM base in Denver, Colorado, and he killed two of the young adults there that were part of that YWAM base. And then he went over to a church, New Life Church there, killed two people there before he was shot by one of the security guards at the church. And he left a note, and this is what this note from that troubled young man said, quote, why didn't any changes occur or any love or help come when I accepted you as Lord and Savior? Some of you perhaps relate to that sentiment, that frustration. God, I don't see the changes that you're making in my life. Certainly the psalmist here, he can relate to that kind of an anguish. As he says, you know, where is God? Or in the next psalm, Psalm 43, and some people believe Psalm 42 and 43 are actually one psalm. There's no heading there in 43, and it uses the same refrain. And he says there in verse 2, you are my God, my stronghold. Why have you rejected me? Oh, that feeling like a knife to the heart from God. God, why have you rejected me? Where are you for me? This is a raw psalm here, isn't it? It's very honest. Very honest with the anguish of life. But there's also hope in that psalm. And that's the verses that the women had read for us. This is not only a psalm of anguish, but it's also a psalm of hope. And he's got that refrain that he says a couple times. Verse 5 is the first time. Why, my soul, are you downcast? Why so disturbed within me? Put your hope in God, for I will yet praise him, my Savior and my God. So in the midst of the valleys, in the midst of the doubts, in the midst of the questions, in the midst of the wondering, in the midst of the anguish, there's this hope, knowing that God is there. Even when he doesn't feel God necessarily, even when his tears are his food day and night, that he knows he's going to put his hope in God. And it's not just a good luck kind of thing. It's not just a psychological thing. But this is, he's using some soul level language here, isn't he? Verse 1, as a deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you. Verse 5, why, my soul, are you so downcast? That at the soul level, he wants to meet with God. That in our pain and adversity and anguish, we cry out to God. What's the lowest point on the earth? Anybody know what that is? No, in the land, not in the oceans. Where's the lowest point on our planet? It's the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea at 1,300 feet below sea level. What's the highest point in the Holy Land? Well, he lists it there in verse 6. My soul is downcast within me, therefore I will remember you from the land of Jordan, the Dead Sea there, the heights of Hermon from Mount Mizar. And there's Mount Hermon on the screen there. And that's 9,000 feet above sea level. So perhaps the psalmist is there looking at this mountain as he sees it towering 9,000 feet up, and yet the Dead Sea down 1,300 feet below sea level. That in the midst of the mountains, the high times of life, God is there as well in the low times. That friends, when you find yourself in the deepest pit, God is deeper still. When you find yourself in the lowest times in life, God is there with you. As well as when you find yourself up on the mountain times of pure joy, that God is with you also. But it's up to you and I to connect with God in the midst of those times. He uses an interesting expression there in verse 7. Deep calls to deep in the roar of your waterfalls. And there's a picture there of waterfalls near Mount Hermon. And perhaps, again, he's looking at these as he's writing. We're not sure exactly what he means by that. Deep calling to deep in the roar of your waterfalls. Maybe as he's looking at this waterfalls, maybe he's thinking about his own circumstances of life, the difficulties, maybe his enemies, whoever they are. And thinking that in the midst of these difficult circumstances, deep calling to deep, his spirit connecting with God, that the depths of God connects with the depths of humanity. Deep calling to deep. And he goes on to have this hope in the next verse, verse 8. By day the Lord directs his love, at night his song is with me. This is the first time he's used that word Lord, referring to God. Everybody say the word Lord. Lord, it's the Hebrew word Yahweh, meaning covenant-keeping God. Up to this point, he's always said God, 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 Elohim, you know, the creator God. In the beginning, God created. But now he uses Yahweh, that this covenant-keeping God, the Lord, the one who has his faithful love, his hesed love, the one that comes out of the covenant, he is the one reaching down to the psalmist. And friends, you and I can know that same hope also. When we're in the midst of our difficult times, we're in the midst of our anguish, the deep calling to deep, that at our soul level, we can connect with God, this God who is a covenant-keeping God, this God who made the new covenant through his Son Jesus Christ's death and resurrection, will reach into your spirit, into your soul. That in the midst of darkness, like the psalmist, by day the Lord directs his love, at night his song is for me. He's gone from my tears or my food day and night to suddenly God's love is with me during the day and his song is with me during the night. That you and I can sing a song of hope in the midst of depression. You and I can sing a song of hope in the midst of despair. You and I can be people of hope, even in those down times, the low times in life. Even when we don't feel it, even when we're not necessarily experiencing it at that moment, but we know that God is faithful. And we reframe our mind knowing that the God who is faithful will carry us through. And we can be people of hope in the midst of these dark times. That hope has the last word for us because it comes from God. That your future is one of hope. Even for the psalmist here, even, you know, regardless of what he was going through, like I said, perhaps in exile and his family perhaps killed by the Babylonians, that he knows there's a word of hope for him. It's a very personal psalm here. Psalm 42, 43, there's more than 50 personal adjectives that are used there. I, my, me, and then God. It's this connecting with God, that God meets us in our dark times. What about you? What about me? When there is adversity, does that cause us to turn towards God or away from God? See, the core of our longings is for transcendence. To connect with this God, deep calling to deep, that God will meet us in those dark times. God will meet us in our pain. God will meet us when things don't go like we planned or hoped they would. It was true 3,000 years ago for the son of Korah as he wrote this psalm, and it's true in 2019 also. I'm going to invite Valerie up here. And Valerie and I had a brief conversation last Sunday. And as I was mulling over this psalm, I think it was on Thursday morning or so, that I was kind of thinking of Valerie's story. So come on up here, Valerie. I'm sorry? Okay. I never quite know. You coming? Not coming? Yeah. Come on up. Great. Yes. Donna will encourage you to come. There you go. So let me give you this microphone and... I know you were saying to me last Sunday that, the summer didn't quite go like you had hoped it would go. What happened?
Catch my breath.
Okay, sure.
So just to backtrack a little bit, we went on the Mexico trip for a mission trip, looking forward to it for a long time. And here I thought, oh, this is going to be perfect. Let's see what I'm going to learn from it. And everything went well. The only worry was recovering from an accident. I thought, well, let's see how physically this will happen. Perfect. Nothing. No pain. No nothing. When we got there, I was bit by a spider. Four times. Not once.
Four times? Four times. Four times bitten by a spider.
Yep.
Okay.
And at this point, I didn't know what it was. We gathered at the fire every evening just to reconnect. And I felt something. I thought, oh, well, whatever. It's nothing. It's hair falling or a branch or whatever. We're going to bed, and I said to Donna, I go, I think I've been bit. And she goes, well, what makes you think that? And there was red spots. Again, didn't think anything of it. We went to bed, and the next day, this red spot's gotten bigger, and it's hurting. Didn't say anything. We carried on, and so the night we arrived is when it happened, because I noticed the following morning. So after a couple of days, so the calf started getting red, and it's swelling, and it's hurting, and it's hard. And the team said, well, why don't we get it looked at? I said, no, we've got work to do. We'll worry about it later. There's nothing wrong with it. But it kept getting bigger. And by the midweek, there was white pus, yellow, purple pus, if you want details. And it's hurting. So still nothing. We've got work to do. And I thought, well, we'll just look at it when we get home. By the middle of the week, now my thigh had started, and that's where the problems arised. And again, didn't think anything of it. We're going to be home soon. Let's finish what we've come to do. We've traveled now. I'm going to fast forward because this is going to take all day. We get home, and I had to go to work, so I did. But I found I couldn't walk properly. Carried on, and I went to see the doctor 2 days after I got in. We got back from Mexico, and the doctor put me on antibiotics, a pill. He didn't think anything of it. He says, yeah, whatever, it's just a bite. Carried on. That was Tuesday. By Thursday, the family doctor said, you need to get IV. So away I went to emergency, and they didn't think anything of it. He looked, and he says, oh, yeah, it's just a bite. We'll treat it. We'll put IV in. So that night, by midnight, I took a reaction to the IV. And I thought I was hallucinating, and I thought I was on something, and the nurse is looking at me, and I go, something's wrong. She goes, oh, that's because you've reacted to the IV. So I said, okay, well, now what? She goes, oh, well, it's expensive. Might as well finish it. So we did. I went home, and so that night they said, come back every day, twice a day, for a bandage change. So the calf by now had finished leaking, but my thigh, the bite had gotten bigger. It looked like a flesh-eating disease by now. So it was the size, a little bigger than a toonie, and it's open. So I said, okay. So I come back in the morning, and the emergency doctor, it was quite comical. I thought it was funny. He's checking my wrist, and he's going, I don't see any bites. And I go, well, they're on my leg. They're not on my wrist. So away he went, and he comes back, and he goes, well, I can't put you back on IV because you reacted to it. And I said, well, I already know that. So he put me on a different pill antibiotic. So away I went home, and I've been taking it Monday, Tuesday. Now, this is the following week. This went on for a couple of days. And by Tuesday, I'm really sore. And even when we were in Mexico, you can put your hand close to my leg, and you can feel the heat. But we didn't think anything of it. I didn't. So by the time the week had come along, and it's about Wednesday or Thursday, I thought, well, maybe I'll just go get it checked out. And my doctor said, you need to get to the hospital. I said, well, no, I don't. It looks fine, you know. And she goes, have you seen the back of your leg? So it spread. So I went into the hospital, got more IV. Well, sorry, before I got there, I said to her, okay, that's fine. She gave me another pill antibiotic. Finished that Friday, I woke up and I had red all around my waist, my legs. I was itchy and it hurt. So I showed her because I went for a bandage change. And she says, you need to get off the antibiotic and I'll see you in a couple days. So this was Friday. By 4 o'clock, I wasn't feeling well and I could just feel my energy drain and I'm looking ghostly. Went home and now I'm shaking out of control. And it was hot in July. So my daughter's looking, and I'm getting blankets. I'm trying to get comfortable. And I said, well, why don't we do this? And now my neck is hurting, head's hurting. I just can't keep it together. So I'm scaring her. And I said, why don't we go to the hospital now instead of at midnight? Right? Why not? We've got to wait there anyway. They got me in right away because the bed I was on was shaking. And the same doctor from the week before, now he's panicking because he let me go, and he doesn't know what has happened. So they started running tests, blood work, right away, and then they ran an MRI and chest x-rays just to rule out meningitis. So by 10:30, he says, oh, you're all good, but I can't let you go because I was running a fever. So I didn't know this at this time. I just thought it was cold because of the air conditioning. So he ran all those tests, and by 1 o'clock, and this is 1 in the morning, he said, I'm not letting you go home. We're admitting you, but we need to do a spinal tap. So he did the spinal tap, and I said, well, I'm here. You might as well go ahead. By 1:30, the results came in. He says, you're fine, but you're still not going home. So they put me in a ward room full of men because they had no room. But then they cordoned, blocked me off so no one comes in because they said it was an infection. Could have told them that 2 weeks ago. And they didn't want it to spread. So then by 10, they ran more tests, more blood work. I guess the doctor on duty, he's very thorough because I was getting blood work every 4 hours by now. And they just couldn't get to the bottom of this. When he came to check up on me, and now the shaking hadn't gone, the fever hadn't gone down, and the leg is worse. When he went to check my kidney area, my kidneys had swollen from all these antibiotics. My arms were swollen, so they changed the IV over. So I'm looking at him, and he's in shock on what is happening, and I'm making laugh light of it. And he's going, aren't you worried? And I go, no, not at all. Where am I going to go? I know where I'm going. And he's looking at me, so he says, okay, he walks away, and he runs more tests. Now, I've been there for a couple of days, and finally, every antibiotic he gave, I was reacting to. So he had to take them all off. I couldn't. Tylenol wasn't doing anything either. Took them off, and he says, I want you to go home because the more I keep you, I'm afraid you're going to catch an infection. said, okay, sure. So I'm getting ready, and he's going to discharge me, and now I'm starting to throw up and everything else. He says, back you go. So I come back in, and Pastor Steve came and prayed with me, and the doctor's watching all the dynamics, right? And he's just thinking, there's got to be something wrong with you. I said, there's not. I've just got a lot of people praying. We thought there was healing, and then there was, and then there was. But nothing. Didn't think anything of it. So I'm going to fast forward. I'm here now. So I think where we wanted to connect is there is ups and downs. There's been so much I've seen in my life, and you know, I'm so blessed to be here today standing. I don't know why. I still don't. But I promised God I wouldn't ask. I wouldn't ask. Just keep leading me. So someone dear and close to my heart phones, you know, see how I'm doing, and threw me for a loop. And he says, and he used other words, where's your God now? I went, what? Where's your God now? And I said, oh, my God's here. You can't see him, but he's here, and he's not done with me yet. That shut him up. He didn't know what to say because he was hoping that I would kind of go, you know what, you're right. I went to do goodwill, and I've come back. I've landed in the hospital. I've got things to do. But to me, in my world, I was raring to go. I've done what I needed to do. I've got so much work, and let me talk to the world. It was just his way of saying, slow down. We're not there yet. We're not finished. There is still plans. That's how I look at it, and that's my faith.
And I love your faith, Valerie, that you're a person of hope in the midst of that. Because Valerie said to me last Sunday, she said, I'd go again next year.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to let that hold you back.
Well, my doctor said, and she was quite funny, she goes, you know, you just recovered from an accident, and now this, look at you. And she goes, I bet you're not going to go again. And I went, well, why wouldn't I, though? Because I can be bit while I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just so happens it was me.
Yes. Thank you. Let's give Valerie a hand. Thanks for sharing that story. Because Valerie's right. Anything can happen to us here. I mean, that spider bite can be a metaphor for anything, right? Any adversity or pain or trouble that you may encounter this summer or may happen to you this fall. Again, the question will be, how are you going to respond? How are you going to react to that? Are you going to be the person who's saying, yeah, where is my God? You know, like in the psalm here. Or are you going to draw closer to God? In the midst of that, deep calling to deep, your spirit connecting with God in the midst of the adversity. Yeah, I see this roller coaster of high times and low times in this psalm. But thirdly, I see that this psalm is this psalm of passion. Like I said at the outset, that to me there's this genre of psalms that are about hungering and thirsting for God, having this passion for God. And he gives the metaphor there in verse 1, as a deer pants for streams of water, so my soul pants for you, my God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When can I go and meet with God? I mean, we've all had our hot and thirsty days, and it's going to be hot this week, and, you know, perhaps you'll be thirsty. Maybe you'll be on a hike or something, and you'll be longing for water. I mean, and for the psalmist, I mean, he's writing from the Jordan, writing, you know, in a desert-like environment. How many have ever been to the desert? Some of you, okay, quite a number of you have been to Osoyoos then, eh? You know, the Canadian desert. I've never actually been there, but somebody told me this summer, the home hardware in Osoyoos is worth the trip. Have you? Okay, you've been. Is it worth it? Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's a home hardware like 5-10 minutes from here, but I gotta. No, it's not the same. Okay, gotta make that trip to the desert to go to Home Hardware, I guess. So the psalmist uses this image here of this deer that's longing for water in the desert, then finds a stream of water and is satisfied. And you and I. In our lives, we need to be doing the same. Devin sang for us earlier from Psalm 28. My heart says of you, seek his face. Your face, Lord, I will seek. Another one of the passion psalms, I'd say, is Psalm 63. You, God, are my God. Earnestly I seek you. I thirst for you. My whole being longs for you in a dry and parched land where there is no water. Very similar language to Psalm 42. Or Psalm 84 would be another one. My soul yearns, even faints, for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out for the living God. That's a regular theme in the Passion Psalms of this God being the living God as opposed to the lifeless idols who have can offer no life from them. That our souls thirst for this living God. That God is the source of life, that we are depend on God. As we sang earlier, Lord, I need you. Having a passion for God. Let's talk about that. It's kind of something kind of difficult to talk about, right? Because there's no blanks on the outline to fill in. There's no like three easy steps, you know, to passion for God. There's no formula that a person can do. And you do this, A, B, C, and then you'll end up with passion for God. It's got to be something that God does within our hearts as we respond to God, that deep calling to deep, us connecting with God, that we have this hunger and then this thirsting in our soul, recognizing that we absolutely need God, that we choose to love what God loves and we choose to hate what God hates. That's not just knowing about God, but it's knowing God. It's being in His presence. It's confessing sin and then loving Him with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. It means that you and I need to create space and time in our schedule, in our life, to be in the presence with Jesus. See, to have a passion for God, the word passion means to be affected by, to be affected by. And so to have a passion for Jesus means to be affected by Jesus. I was thinking this week of that story of in Luke chapter 10 of Mary and Martha, and Jesus comes to visit them in their home. And Martha is distracted by making the meal for Jesus. And that's normal Near Eastern hospitality to do that. But Mary decides to place a higher value of sitting at the feet of Jesus as opposed to preparing a meal for Him. There's nothing wrong with making a meal for Jesus. I think if I ever preach on that passage, Luke 10, I think the problem for Martha was she was trying to do like a 7-course meal instead of a 1-course meal. And I'll explain it when we look at that passage. But, you know, Mary decides that she's going to sit at the feet of Jesus. And yeah, if Jesus commands her, you know, go up and get up and help your sister prepare the meal, she's going to do that, but it's going to take a command from Jesus for her to get up because she's going to sit at the feet of Jesus because nothing compares with being in His presence. So Martha, she tries to get Jesus to rebuke Mary for sitting at His feet, but Jesus doesn't rebuke her. In fact, He commends her for what she's chosen. That being with Him is even greater than serving Him. Now there's another event in these sisters' lives. The gospel writer John records it, that their brother Lazarus passed away. So Jesus and the disciples, they travel to Bethany. And when they arrive there, Martha is the first one to see Jesus. And she says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. And then Jesus gives one of the greatest theological statements in the Gospels. He says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die. And then a few moments later, Mary comes up to Jesus. She says the identical words to Jesus. She says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But Jesus at that point, instead of going into a sermon or giving some great theological thought, He begins to cry. And then He goes over to Lazarus's tomb and He raises Lazarus from the dead. Two sisters, same statement, but vastly different reactions from Jesus. One results in a great theological truth. The other moves Jesus to tears and to action. Now, maybe you don't want to read into it too much, but I'm just wondering that those who sit in the presence of Jesus, those who have a passion for Jesus, can move His heart and His hand in ways that others can't. What about you spending time with Jesus? What about me? What will be the result of that? Because I think we see a little bit of that pattern in the Scriptures. Mark chapter 3, why don't we stick it up on the screen, Mark. And let's read it together there. Mark chapter 3, verses 13 to 15. Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted. And they came to him. He appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. Notice the order of things there. Does it start with preaching? Does it start with healing? No, it starts with that they might be with him. It begins with you and I being with Jesus. And then any of the activity, any of the doing comes after the being, the spending time in his presence. I'm excited about our church-wide fall campaign, which is called Rooted. And we've got these Rooted adult journals. We've ordered 330 copies of them. There's some great topics that we're going to be covering in the 10 weeks together. How does God speak to us? Where is God in the midst of suffering? Overcoming the enemy in our life? How can I make the most of my life, etc.? So there'll be like 5 days a week. It'll take like 10 to 15 minutes. Then we've got also a student version that Pastor Chris has ordered. And the same themes on there, except 5 days a week. It's only 3 days a week for the students. And then our KU team is coming up with a Rooted passport for our kids to be using. And there's memory challenge, family challenge, design challenge, all kinds of challenges that they're working on. And this is only one tool, but it's a tool that you and I can use and our discipleship groups will be using, and that together as a church, we're going to be intentionally making time to spend with Jesus. And we'll be accountable to one another in our D groups. And we'll be talking about the things that we're hearing from Jesus as we're taking the time daily to be in his presence. And I'm looking forward to what God is going to do in your life and in mine. See, friends, only you can spend time for you with Jesus, right? Nobody else can do that for you, right? I can't do that for you. Your spouse can't do it for you. Your discipleship group can't do it for you. Only you can make the time and the space to spend time with Jesus. Nobody else can do that for you. See, getting a passion for God isn't something that you can catch like a cold, right? You can catch a cold from your kids. You know, you can catch a cold from somebody else, but you can't catch passion for Jesus from someone else, right? You can't meet somebody in the lobby after church and they kind of sneeze on you and they're passionate for God and suddenly you're passionate for God. There's no secondhand passion for God. It's got to come individually from each of us being in the presence of Jesus. That we get affected by Jesus because we're with him. Like Mary, we're sitting at the feet of Jesus. And I believe that spending time with him is a game changer. That our core identity is being God's children. And that following him is more than just living right, but it's living fully. It's being fully alive as God's children. It's the cry of Romans chapter 8. Verse 11 says, when God lives and breathes in you, and he does, as surely as he did in Jesus, you are delivered from that dead life with his spirit living in you, and your body will be as alive as Christ. The resurrection life you receive from God is not a timid, grave-tending life. It's an adventurously expectant greeting God with a child like, what's next, Papa? That's the adventure we live, friends. Like the psalmist, we live lives of the roller coaster up and down. We have our times of lament and anguish. We have our times of hope and joy and everything in between. But in the midst of that, we thirst and hunger for God. We have this passion to meet with God because we believe that God changes everything. Being with God changes everything. And that his kingdom is above all else. As we sang earlier, it's the treasure that we'll seek that is beyond anything else. Because God has demonstrated his love for us through the cross. And he invites us into his presence. He invites us to follow him. And that as we do that, we live this adventure. That we see him in the midst of whatever spider bites we may find ourselves facing in life. That we know that Jesus is real. And he's speaking to us. So let's seek him, friends. Let's be a church that's passionate for God. Let's be a church that desires everything that God has for us. Let's pray. Oh, let's take a few moments of silent prayer. Oh, this beautiful psalm. As a deer pants for water, so my soul longs for you. God brought you here, friends. Let him speak to you now. Oh, Jesus, I just pray that you would fill me with a longing for you, that everything else in this world just pales in comparison. I pray that you would fill us with hearts that hunger after you, that desire you above all else, because you are what matters most. Oh, Jesus, I pray that you would just make us into a people that just want to be with you. That we'll put aside those things that sidetrack us or distract us. To be there to listen to you, the one who loves us more than we could ever imagine. And Jesus, you'll speak. You'll speak in the midst of our own laments and hard times we go through. You'll speak when we're at a crossroads. You'll speak when you're calling us to take bold steps of faith. You'll speak your word of love to us, your beloved children. In your name we pray, amen.